I think we're about on time, so we'll go ahead and get started. Let me introduce myself to begin with. I'm Rob Mickelson. I work with a group called the International Plant Nutrition Institute, a nonprofit group that has scientists all over the world helping farmers and society use plant nutrients more effectively. And so when asked to talk about this subject, this workshop, where do I begin, really? And so the point of this workshop is diagnosing the need for plant nutrition. And so I think the didn't turn out quite like they planned, but there was someone to talk about soils, plants, infield measurements, visual diagnostics. And so we've had a couple cancellations just in the last few days, but we're going to kick this off and get started and appreciate your attendance. I don't think most of you need convincing that plant nutrition is important. And I think anyone in horticulture has had plenty of exposure to this. But just wanted to point out some examples from around the world to set the stage for some of our discussion today. So what I want to talk about just briefly is food security and poverty alleviation, yield and quality, resource sustainability, briefly touch on water use efficiency, the impact on human health and the environment, and then how to implement this proper nutrition program that I'm going to tell you is so important. So each of these topics could easily be an hour lecture on their own, but I'm just going to hit some, maybe not even the best examples, but a couple examples on each of these and just keep you thinking about the role of plant nutrition in these different areas. So let's talk about poverty alleviation and food security to start with. This, again, if you don't work in this area, you don't realize how fundamental this is. I just put a couple of references down on the bottom, but they estimate that about half of the global food supply is sustained by the use of fertilizers. So in other words, if we didn't have fertilizers, we would produce about half the amount of food. Now, there's some argument about, well, could manure take the place of that fertilizer, or could green manures? And to some extent, that could take place. But if we're growing green manure cover crops, that means there's land that's taken out of food production that now needs to be used for growing legumes. And also, much of the manure gets their nutrients from fertilizer. Fertilized crops are fed to the cows that then produce the manure that has the nutrients in it. So that number is not a hard number, but whatever it is, the experts agree it's a lot of the world's food supply is attributed to fertilizer. So obviously we need to do a good job with managing that. And we'll need to produce more food in the coming years. They estimate at least 50% more food than we're producing now needs to be produced in the next 30 to 40 years. So the options to do that are either have more land or intensify the land that we're using already. Now, when you talk about intensifying the production, that makes me and probably you a little bit nervous, because we can't just do more of what we're doing now, because what we're doing now in many places is not very sustainable. There's environmental impacts offsite on water, on the air, on the soil. So when I'm saying we need more, doesn't mean we need to do more of what we're doing now. So as part of the discussion today is how we can be smarter about growing this food that is going to be needed in the years to come. So one of the joys of working for a global institute is I get to see these examples on a regular basis of how plant nutrition directly benefits families and villages. This is a case study we worked on with a village in Peru, where they were primarily growing coffee in a very unsustainable way. The soils were very poor, so when the coffee yields went down, they would just clear some new hillside and plant coffee. After about 5 or 10 years, those plants would not do well, so they would clear more hillside and plant new coffee plants. Just sort of scraping by, but enough to keep their family going. We said, well, if you manage your existing coffee plants more sustainably, give them a little bit of nutrients, a little bit of management, the yields will be much better. And indeed, when they did that, they just said that we can't believe what this has done. We now have enough coffee to sell that we can send our children to school. we can send them to the doctor. And just again, from a handful of nutrients used. This was one of the most inspiring books that I read a few years ago, and just put it up here because it was amazing to me. This The Last Hunger Season. This author documents how this 1 acre fund in Kenya impacts these farmers, where just, again, a handful of fertilizer and a little bit of knowledge on how to grow crops transforms families. That's called The Last Hunger Season because this is the last time they were hungry in these families' lives. Because now they had a little bit of education and they had a little bit of nutrition to feed their crops. I highly recommend this book. And there's another book by this author that I'm going to refer to in just a minute. So on that list of topics that I started off with, let's talk about yield and quality. Again, this is obvious for, I think, all of us here, how nutrition impacts yield and quality. Especially for horticultural crops, this is especially important. I just pulled out a couple examples. This is from a colleague near where I live. This is from the Salinas Valley in Monterey, California. They're doing work on nitrogen-responsive spinach. Well, no nitrogen, 40 pounds of nitrogen, 80 pounds of nitrogen. Guess which one the farmers prefer and which one the consumers will buy? It's the 80 pounds. No, 80 pounds is probably a little more than I would like them to use. But you see there's a visual and a yield response there that incentivizes farmers to use that much. And that part of this workshop is to say, well, how do we know when we have enough? When can we cut it back? Can you get too much of a good thing? Well, obviously, you can. Another example from California is broccoli. When you look at the tissue nitrogen concentration and marketable broccoli yield, in general, more nitrogen in the plant means more harvested broccoli yield. So do we need to go to the highest yield? Maybe economically, often we shoot for 90 or 95% of maximum yield, but maybe we need to look at the environmental impact as well. So those aren't always factored into these types of graphs. Dr. Pichet is going to talk to us later about some nutrient deficiency symptoms and how to use those as a diagnostic tool for nutrient management. But again, just from broccoli examples, you can see the effect of nitrogen in this case and the effect on the harvested marketable yield. So if the farmer is short on nutrition, they're not going to sell their crop. The brokers will not buy that crop on the left. And other things about just consumer preference, how appealing it is, whether you can sell your crop or not. In general, studies have found that consumers demand and will pay for high quality products. I'm sure you've all had the experience of going to maybe the farmer's market and you'll be behind someone that's looking for the very perfect tomato. You know, they're going through the whole pile to look for that perfect piece of fruit that they take home and shred into pieces or cut into slices. But people want high quality, beautiful looking produce. It doesn't taste any better than one that's a little bit shriveled or something, but there is definitely a consumer demand for high quality product. I just picked an example of potassium. I could have picked any of the nutrients here, but crops with sufficient potassium, they have higher protein, oil, vitamins, functional compounds. The taste is improved. I'm thinking of an example with cantaloupe and tomatoes, where the flavor is enhanced with adequate potassium. So there's a lot of these secondary effects of proper nutrition that also affect both the taste and the visual appeal. With potassium as well, when there's adequate potassium, they have fewer pests, fewer diseases, less nitrate, in part because of the cell wall integrity is improved. And this article by Wang et al. In 2013 describes the role of potassium in some of these areas very well. Again, with potassium, just because I couldn't do them all, it often promotes more favorable fruit appearance. Here's some examples from citrus. You see a lack of potassium results in more fruit splitting, small skin, smaller fruit. So again, the farmer is definitely incentivized for quality purposes to get the nutritional aspects right. If they mess up on this, they might grow a nice plant, but they won't have a product to sell. And continuing on our potassium theme, as it affects the appearance of the food, here's yellow shoulder, some work that's been done in California as well. When potassium is sort of adequate or marginal, the fruit produces this yellow shoulder. So when you cut up that fruit to make salsa, instead of nice red chunks, now you have yellow chunks. And the quality of the fruit is not acceptable for many purposes. So this yellow shoulder, to a large degree, can be eliminated by making sure you have adequate potassium. So again, we could do this with all the nutrients, with phosphorus, with micronutrients, and I just had to pick one, but this, you know, some clear examples of why adequate nutrition affects the quality and the quantity of our produce. So a third reason of why nutrient management is important is for the purposes of resource sustainability. There's only so much to go around in the world, right? And we don't want to waste it. Whether it's fertilizer or manure or whatever the nutrient source is, I think we're all on board with, well, let's be wise stewards of these scarce resources. And sort of depending on where you're coming from, some people view manure more as a waste. Let's get rid of it. Let's get it out of the barn so I can grow my next flock of chickens or pigs or whatever it may be. But I think we're all sort of a consensus that this is a valuable nutrient. Just quickly wanted to go through where fertilizer comes from and sort of the sustainability outlooks. You may not have ever really thought about where that stuff in the bag comes from, but potassium in particular all comes from ancient seas, ancient oceans. They're either buried way underground or they may be at the surface still. If you've flown over the Great Salt Lake, they're mining potash out of the Great Salt Lake. Same in the Dead Sea in between Jordan and Israel. The buried potash, the closest reserves here are from New Mexico or Saskatoon, where they go down about a half a mile and dig this stuff out from ancient salt brines. And there's a lot of potassium in the world. They estimate there's, you know, at least 1,000 years of potassium resources that are waiting to be tapped that we know of now. And quickly on nitrogen. Nitrogen is really a problem nutrient because the Haber-Bosch process, which revolutionized agriculture, depends on a steady supply of hydrogen. The hydrogen goes into making ammonia. So we have lots of nitrogen in the air, but we don't have the hydrogen. So hydrogen comes from natural gas, comes from coal, comes from various organic materials where we extract the hydrogen. And so these rely primarily on fossil fuels. So whenever we apply nitrogen fertilizer, wherever the source is, we're using a fossil fuel-derived material. Because from ammonia, they can make nitrate, urea, they can make lots of nitrogen compounds, but it all starts with this first process of hydrogen and nitrogen being combined. So this is definitely a scarce material as well and depends on fossil fuels. Phosphate, we'll stop after phosphorus. This could be a lecture by itself, but most of these come from, again, these are marine sediments that we mine. There's an example from Florida at the top, North Carolina there at the bottom, and a phosphate mine in Idaho with the Simplot Corporation. So they take off the overburden and scrape the stuff up and transform it into fertilizer. Just wanted to briefly touch on this. About 10 years ago, there was a lot of interest in this concept called peak phosphate or peak phosphorus. They said the world is running out of phosphorus and we need to do something. You may remember some of those stories. And you may not have heard as much about it recently because they went back and did a reassessment of how much phosphorus there really is in the world. And they said, oh, whoops, there is a lot out there still. So if we look at this peak phosphorus, I left this one blank on how many years we have in some of these different countries. so you could sort of guess before I unveil it. But so in Algeria, they estimate they could have about 2,000 year supply. Morocco is an interesting one. Morocco has about 70% of the world's phosphorus supply in Morocco. So when everyone else runs out, Morocco is just going to keep going. But there is a lot of phosphorus in Morocco. United States doesn't look so good. They estimate that the reserves in Florida and North Carolina will be gone, you know, within our lifetimes, at least. So we'll be dependent on imports. So again, phosphorus is a scarce resource. There's only so much of that element in the world, and we use it very inefficiently. We put a lot on the soil. We take a little bit off in the crop. A lot of it gets washed down into rivers and creeks and streams. It gets flushed down the toilet. There's a lot of places where phosphorus goes, and we do a lousy job of recycling it. So maybe our generation's not going to have to worry about this, but as we get towards that 100-year, 200-year mark, they're going to be a little more serious about this than perhaps we are. So is the world running out of phosphorus? Well, in the big picture, yes. It's not a problem immediately, though. Actually, the price of phosphate is quite low now. Water use efficiency, another one that we could spend a lot of time on, and I chose not to spend a lot of time on this one. There's a nice paper here that was published a few years ago about improving water use efficiency by nutrient management, and they go through each nutrient and talk about its relation with water use efficiency. And they've diagrammed sort of the biological responses and the physiology, and you know, it gets into way more detail than I have time today, but again, we hear a lot about the looming water crisis in the world, how we need to use water more effectively, especially in irrigated lands, but also in rain-fed areas. And so proper nutrition is going to have a big impact on this as well. Quickly about human diets. There are a lot of humans that are malnourished. And again, we probably just had a big breakfast. We're going to have a great lunch, a wonderful dinner. And it may not even be on your radar often. Zinc, iron, iodine, selenium, copper, magnesium, calcium, and potassium are the nutrients that human nutritionists worry about. And in the United States, we're often worried about overconsumption. But even in the United States, zinc, iron, and sometimes selenium, I would suspect that almost everyone in this room is low in potassium. They estimate that at least 3/4 of Americans are low in dietary potassium. And that affects your blood pressure, your heart function, a lot of different things. And horticulturists can do something about that. Fruits and vegetables are one of the most important sources of potassium in the diet, and by manipulating the plant nutrition, we can get more potassium into the harvested product of many crops. Just quickly, especially zinc and vitamin A are a big problem worldwide. They cause stunted growth, mental impairment, muscle wastage, and these things last for a lifetime. Especially if infants don't get the proper zinc and vitamin A, they'll have mental retardation, if I can say that. And it's fixed. It's permanent. A child is stunted and they'll never grow to the proper height. So they estimate that malnutrition is the cause of about half of children's deaths a year. And just for your information, about a third of the global population is deficient in zinc. So it is a major issue. And again, crop nutrition can play a major role in alleviating this. Again, I mentioned this Roger Thoreau earlier, and he wrote a wonderful book, again, very inspirational, called The First 1,000 Days. And that's the first 1,000 days of a human's life. And that will set the stage for the next 40, 50, 60, 80 years by getting the proper nutrition those first few years. Now, again, if you're interested in this topic, both of these Roger Thoreau books, you'll be so excited about plant nutrition, you won't be able to stop talking about it. Just a couple other things that we'll talk about. Potassium again. I was using a potassium example earlier. But I mentioned that almost all human diets are deficient in potassium. And the nutritionists look at it and they say, these pills are not the same as food. You can take a potassium pill, but it doesn't replace good nutrition. So in terms of looking at some of these malnourished children, you could give them a pill, but it's not as effective as giving them healthy food. And just thinking of some of these things, potassium, for example, is important in lycopene production. These nutraceutical compounds, isoflavones, beta-glucones, these compounds that are so important for our health, again, they're regulated by an adequate potassium supply. And tomatoes and lots of different crops have these health beneficial compounds that are regulated by nutrition. Just an example, some work from Cornell looking at the lycopene concentration in potato and tomatoes, and you can see that it goes up as the potassium supply in the soil increases. And all kinds of nutraceutical foods that have been linked with proper plant nutrition. So again, you know, we can spend a lot of time talking about these. I'm just trying to sort of refresh your memory on things you've heard and learned and already know, I think, but hoping it's not too repetitive. This is a great organization as well, if you're not familiar with this. They won the World Food Prize a couple years ago called Harvest Plus, and their goal is improving the nutrient content of food. Sound like something we're interested into? If you haven't seen this organization, you really ought to go to their website sometime. And biofortification can be done in many ways. One is improved fertilization. One is improved genetics and plant breeding. And it's improving access to healthy foods. Just put a couple things up here. They're looking at zinc in maize, biofortified pearl millet for anemia, vitamin A orange maize, which contains, again, more of the vitamin A, pearl millet with iron. So it's a great organization, and so we're all on board with this plant nutrition and human health interest. Let's see if I can get this. Another important reason why we care about plant nutrition is the environment. Whether you're looking at a controlled environment in a greenhouse, for example, or if you're working in the field, a lot of attention is being paid to, now tell me how you manage these nutrients and where do they go if the plants don't take them up? But this efficiency discussion that we have, again, really important and something that's on the minds of the public a lot. For example, the Gulf of Mexico drains about 2/3 of the United States. Also, the richest agricultural region of North America. A lot of these organic soils, these mollisol soils that contain a lot of nitrogen, and as they decompose, they release nutrients. Farmers apply a lot of fertilizer in this region. And I'm afraid you've seen pictures like this before of the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. The red is very low oxygen, and then as the colors transform to green and then to blue, then that's higher levels of oxygen. So the nutrients, primarily nitrogen and phosphorus, are contributing to the algae growth. And then when they die, they remove the oxygen from the water. Again, this is not new for any of you, but it's happening in other parts of the world. I'm on the border between Uruguay and Argentina. They have a hypoxic area that appears regularly. There's places in Europe where this happens, the Baltic Sea, for example. So it really shows the urgency to manage nutrients better, both for the farmers and for environmental purposes. This has been in the news a number of times the last few years, the Lake Erie watershed. And primarily this is the result of phosphorus, both from water treatment plants not being adequately and treating the water, also from the crop farmers in Ohio, where that region is draining to Lake Erie. I guess it was a couple years ago where the city of Toledo, which sort of south of Detroit there a bit, they had to shut down their drinking water intake from the lake because of the high concentrations of algae and some of the associated compounds with the algae. Got a lot of attention. So a lot of work is going on in this area on improving nutrient management. Something closer to home in California, we're dealing a lot with nitrate contamination of groundwater. And those red dots that are scattered around are not tourist spots, but they're contaminated wells. Those are domestic drinking water wells, not the agricultural wells. So there's a lot of work going on helping the farmers use their nitrogen more effectively. And they're saying, well, I want to do what's right. Give me the tools to know what to do. Give me the diagnostic tools to test my soil, to test my crop, to predict what I'm going to need. And that's what we're sort of gathering here to talk about today. Another issue besides water quality is greenhouse gases. And they estimate that agriculture contributes about close to 8% of the greenhouse gases in the United States. And primarily that's CO2, nitrous oxide, and methane. Now, the CO2 and the methane, they are a little bit linked with nutrient management, probably not terribly directly, but nitrous oxide is emitted every time we put nitrogen fertilizer in the soil. Every time we put manure in the soil, every time we put a cover crop back in the soil, nitrous oxide is emitted. So how do we do a better job with that? How do we manage those nutrients to eliminate or to minimize the emissions of nitrous oxide? I don't know that we can eliminate it, but there's certain practices we can do that will minimize it at least. Skip over that one. So how do we implement this proper nutrition? And I'm hoping we can have some discussion today about that. And it really begins, I think, with the proper diagnosis of the situation. Can you imagine going to the doctor and they say, well, I'm not feeling well. Well, here's some pills. Well, is it a brain tumor? Or is it constipation? Or is it athlete's foot? Well, just take these pills and I'm sure you'll feel better. You think this doctor is a quack. No, you need to start with, well, what's the problem? What's the issue? What's bothering you? How can we help you fix the problem? And so often we are a bit quick to offer remedies before we go through a thorough diagnosis. Whether it's the soil, the plant, the water, whatever we need to do to know how to manage these things. The organization I work with, we promote this concept called the 4R nutrient stewardship model, which is using the right source of fertilizer, putting it on at the right rate, putting it on in the right place, and putting it on at the right time. But you can't even begin to implement this 4R strategy until you know what the problem is. So, and it's very crop and site specific, so it takes a lot of expertise from the people in this room to empower the farmers to know how to do this correctly. So we organized a great workshop, and in the last few days we've had a few changes